The Housemaid by Freda McFadden took the literary world by storm when it was published in 2022, becoming an instant New York Times bestseller and captivating millions of readers. This psychological thriller has since spawned a series that continues to dominate bestseller lists, with celebrities like Reese Witherspoon and Stephen King praising McFadden's masterful suspense writing. The book's cultural impact extends beyond sales numbers. It sparked widespread social media discussions about domestic suspense and the hidden dangers lurking in seemingly perfect homes. What makes this story particularly compelling is how it taps into universal anxieties about trust, family secrets, and the facades we maintain in our most intimate spaces. As we step into the world of Millie Accardi and her family, prepare for a journey where nothing is quite as it seems behind closed doors. Millie Accardi is in love with her new house at 14 Locust Street. The spacious living room with its original crown molding, floor-to-ceiling picture windows that flood the space with natural light, and expansive lawns dotted with century-old oak trees represent everything she's ever wanted for her family. Moving from their cramped two-bedroom Bronx apartment, where the children shared a room and the kitchen doubled as a laundry area, to this suburban Long Island farmhouse feels like a dream come true. The fact that they managed to get it at 10% below asking price seems almost too good to be true, especially in this seller's market. Her husband Enzo, an Italian landscaper known throughout the Bronx for his irresistible charm and artistic touch with gardens, sees endless possibilities in the overgrown yard. Their children react differently. 11-year-old Ada mourns leaving her best friend behind, while 9-year-old Nico excitedly plans his new treehouse location. As they unpack moving boxes in the fading autumn light, Millie notices someone watching them from house number 13 across the cul-de-sac. A shadowy figure partially hidden behind lace curtains that twitch closed when spotted. This first glimpse of their neighbor foreshadows the intense scrutiny they'll face in their new community, where being Italian-American makes them stand out among the predominantly WASP residents. Soon after, they meet Suzette Lowell, their glamorous neighbor from number 12, who arrives uninvited with a store-bought apple pie and immediately begins flirting with Enzo while making backhanded comments about their quaint and cute house compared to her much larger colonial revival. Despite Millie's growing discomfort with Suzette's obvious interest in her husband, from unnecessary touches on his arm to suggestive comments about his strong hands, she reluctantly agrees to dinner at the Lowells, feeling trapped by suburban social obligations. The cul-de-sac's complex social dynamics quickly become apparent. Suzette is the self-appointed queen bee who flaunts her tennis club membership and designer wardrobe while orchestrating the neighborhood's social calendar, while Janice from across the street is the neighborhood watchdog who monitors everyone's comings and goings with judgmental precision, keeping detailed notes about garbage day violations and lawn maintenance schedules. Both women, in their different ways, make Millie question whether moving to this seemingly perfect but increasingly unfriendly neighborhood was a terrible mistake. What's most unsettling, however, is the strange scraping sound Millie begins hearing at night, a rhythmic scratching that seems to come from within the walls themselves, always starting at precisely 3:15 a.m. When she investigates, flashlight in hand and heart pounding, the sound mysteriously stops, leaving only the echo of movement in the walls. These nocturnal disturbances leave her to wonder what secrets their new home might be hiding, why the previous owners left so suddenly, and why they got such a good deal on a house in this desirable neighborhood where properties typically sell well above asking price. Dinner at the Lowells' house is an exercise in humiliation for Millie and her family. Suzette relegates the children to a tiny table despite ample room at the main table, strategically seats herself next to Enzo, and mocks Millie for using the wrong fork. The food is admittedly incredible. Enzo is moved to tears by pasta alla Norma that tastes just like his grandmother's cooking. But Suzette uses this moment to point out that Millie doesn't cook this dish for him, making her feel inadequate. Jonathan Lowell, Suzette's husband, presents a stark contrast to his pretentious wife. He's immediately likable, unassuming, with a gentle handshake and genuine warmth. When Millie apologizes for their small house, he says he would have preferred it to their ostentatious one. Though he verbally agrees with Suzette that they've always shared a dislike of children, his morose expression suggests otherwise, making Millie wonder if he's sacrificed his desire for parenthood to accommodate his wife. As the weeks pass, Suzette's interest in Enzo becomes increasingly obvious. She offers to help his landscaping business by recommending him to her real estate clients, then suggests he give her a private demonstration in their backyard. Soon, Millie discovers Enzo visiting Suzette's house without telling her, despite his promise to keep her informed. Though he explains these visits as business opportunities they desperately need to pay for their house, Millie can't shake her suspicions. Meanwhile, Janice watches everything from across the street, photographing Enzo and Suzette's interactions and later using these images to fuel Millie's jealousy. She takes pleasure in delivering the news that Enzo has been at Suzette's house for an hour without Millie's knowledge, clearly enjoying the discord she's sowing. The neighbor's intrusion into Millie's life extends beyond mere gossip. Suzette recommends her housekeeper, Martha, who begins cleaning for the Accardis twice a month. Martha's presence makes Millie uncomfortable. She stands rigidly, watching intently, barely speaking. Later, Millie catches Martha going through her desk drawers and suspects her of stealing when money goes missing from their bedroom. 9-year-old Nico begins exhibiting disturbing behavioral changes shortly after their move to Sycamore Lane. Initially, a bright, outgoing child who spent hours practicing his baseball pitch in the backyard and eagerly introducing himself to neighborhood kids, his personality shifts dramatically after an unfortunate accident. While showing off his curveball to potential new friends, he accidentally breaks one of Suzette's prized stained glass windows, an irreplaceable piece she'd crafted herself over several months. Unable to afford the thousands needed for replacement, Millie suggests Nico work off his debt through daily chores at the Lowell's house. Though Suzette's disdain for children is well known in the neighborhood, evidenced by her frequent complaints about playground noise and her meticulously maintained child-free yard, she surprisingly agrees to the arrangement. The transformation begins subtly. After starting his visits to the Lowells, Nico becomes increasingly secretive and withdrawn. He spends every afternoon at their house from 3:30 to 5, but when asked about his activities there, he responds with vague mumbles or changes the subject entirely. Where he once enthusiastically shared details about his day at the dinner table, he now picks at his food in silence, barely eating and rushing to retreat to his bedroom, where the sound of his door locking has become a nightly ritual. His sister Ada, traditionally his closest confidant, attempts to draw him out with their favorite card games and comic books, but he rebuffs her efforts with uncharacteristic hostility. More alarmingly, Nico's behavior grows aggressive and escalating incidents. During a crucial Little League game, when called out at first base on a close play, he violently punches the opposing team's first baseman in the stomach, causing the boy to vomit on the field. At school, a minor disagreement over basketball rules during recess results in Nico attacking another third grader, landing a punch that sends the boy to the emergency room with a suspected broken nose. Though Enzo initially dismisses these incidents as normal boy behavior that will toughen him up, Millie watches in horror as her once gentle son becomes someone she barely recognizes. Perhaps most disturbing is the shift in Nico's relationship with his beloved pet praying mantis, Professor Green. Where he once spent hours observing and caring for the insect, taking detailed notes about its behavior and feeding habits, his interest turns cold. When the mantis dies during a molting accident, Nico shows no trace of the emotional child who once cried over dead butterflies. Instead, he flushes the insect down the toilet without ceremony, his face blank and eyes distant. Desperate for answers, Millie finds herself conducting late-night internet searches about childhood psychopathy, her stomach churning as she recognizes too many traits: the newfound lack of empathy, compulsive lying, cruelty to animals, and escalating aggressive behavior. What remains hidden from the family, obscured behind the Lowells' perfectly maintained Victorian facade and carefully trimmed hedges, is the sinister influence taking hold during Nico's afternoon visits, a darkness that will eventually shatter their suburban community's peaceful veneer and force long-buried secrets into the harsh light of day. The Accardi house contains a mysterious hidden room discovered behind an innocuous crack in the vintage floral wallpaper beneath the stairwell. The revelation comes during a frantic search when Millie and Enzo can't find their children one Saturday afternoon. When they finally locate them inside this small, windowless space lit by a single flickering bulb hanging from exposed wiring, their initial relief at finding them safe quickly turns to confusion and concern. Their son Nico, always the adventurous one, proudly shows off what he calls his secret clubhouse, completely unaware of the unsettling implications of such a hidden space. The room itself is barely 8 feet square, with walls covered in thick foam insulation panels yellowed with age. This explains why their increasingly desperate calls went unheard during the search. The space contains nothing but dust, a few candy wrappers left by the children, and peculiar scratch marks near the base of the walls. The construction suggests it was built decades ago, though its purpose remains unclear. The door is cleverly designed to blend seamlessly with the wallpaper when closed, operating on hidden hinges that make that distinctive scraping sound Millie had been hearing during sleepless nights. Enzo, ever practical, initially sees potential in the space, perhaps a wine cellar or storage room, but Millie's reaction is visceral and immediate. Her claustrophobia, stemming from being locked in a closet for hours as a child by her alcoholic mother, makes even looking into the room unbearable. After a heated discussion, Enzo relents, and they decide to seal it permanently, carefully matching the original 1970s wallpaper pattern to hide its existence. The parallel discovery in the Lowell's house proves far more sinister. While helping Mrs. Lowell with yard work, Nico stumbles upon their hidden room, also concealed beneath the stairs, but meticulously designed as a child's paradise. The space is larger, carpeted in plush blue material, and filled with carefully arranged toys, pristine transformers still in their boxes, remote-controlled trucks, limited-edition action figures, and even a small TV with video games. It's a calculated trap designed to lure children with promises of forbidden treasures. Ada's later investigation of this room reveals its true horror. Beyond the toys, she finds a narrow bed with restraints hidden beneath the mattress. The quilt, decorated with detailed butterfly and beetle patterns, appears innocent until she pulls it back to reveal extensive bloodstains, some old and brown, others disturbingly fresh. The walls, when examined with UV light, show evidence of cleaned blood spatter. Forensics eventually match DNA samples to Braden Lundy, the 7-year-old who vanished while riding his bike 3 years earlier, as well as traces from two other missing children from neighboring counties. The parallel secret spaces serve as powerful metaphors for the suburban facade. The Accardi's hidden room, though unsettling, contained nothing more sinister than children's innocent play. Meanwhile, behind the Lowell's immaculate exterior, their perfect lawn, expensive cars, and reputation for generosity, lurked a chamber designed for unspeakable crimes, representing the darkness that can exist behind seemingly ideal suburban lives. Millie Accardi carries a dark secret that shapes her every interaction and haunts her daily existence. 10 years earlier, as a frightened 16-year-old, she killed a boy who was attempting to rape her best friend Sarah behind the school gymnasium. In a moment of desperate fury, she grabbed a heavy crystal paperweight from a nearby desk and struck him repeatedly until he stopped breathing. Despite the clear circumstances of self-defense and protection, the boy's wealthy and influential parents, the Prestots, used their connections to ensure she faced severe consequences. She served 10 years in Bayview Women's Correctional Facility under her birth name, Wilhelmina Calloway, watching her youth slip away behind steel bars. This history leaves Millie constantly vigilant, analyzing every casual conversation for hidden threats and living in perpetual fear that her carefully constructed facade will crumble. She checks her rearview mirror obsessively, startles at unexpected knocks, and maintains detailed mental notes of everyone who might know her secret. When Martha, the sharp-eyed housekeeper, discovers her past through old newspaper clippings hidden in Millie's desk drawer, she begins a calculated campaign of blackmail. Martha threatens to expose Millie's status as an ex-con to Suzette and the entire neighborhood mom group if Millie reports her systematic theft of family heirlooms and jewelry. The constant fear of exposure creates a suffocating paranoia that colors every interaction, making Millie question the genuine friendliness of neighbors and the innocent questions of her children's teachers. This history leaves his own dark history that emerges in painful fragments throughout their marriage. Though he initially presents as a charming landscaper with a thick Italian accent and an easy smile, his past reveals deeper shadows. For 8 years, he worked as an enforcer for his brother-in-law Dario Fontana, a notorious Boston mobster whose violence knew no bounds. His sister Antonia's death, beaten to death by Dario while Enzo was away on business, haunts him with crushing guilt. This trauma explains his compulsive need to help others in danger, particularly his immediate response to assist Martha when she needs to escape her abusive husband, even though she had been blackmailing his wife. These buried histories create a complex dynamic between Millie and Enzo, a marriage built on mutual understanding of darkness and redemption. They've both done things that wake them in cold sweats at night, yet they've managed to build a loving family and find moments of genuine joy. As Millie reflects during a quiet moment in their garden, "The truth is, we've both done some terrible things in our past, unspeakable things we justify as serving justice. But between us, I'm the one who's done far worse. I didn't just fail to prevent death like Enzo, I actively caused it." Their daughter Ada has inherited more than just her father's striking black hair and olive skin. She carries within her DNA her mother's fierce protective instinct and capacity for decisive violence when threatened. This genetic legacy becomes devastatingly apparent when Ada confronts Jonathan Lowell after discovering his predatory behavior toward her younger brother, demonstrating that sometimes the darkest parts of ourselves live on in ways we never expected. The simmering tensions in the cul-de-sac explode when Jonathan Lowell is found dead with his throat slit, the blood still fresh on the floor of his home. Millie discovers the body after entering the unlocked Lowell house, only to flee home and find Enzo in their kitchen washing blood from his hands. He claims he cut himself with clippers, but the small cut on his palm couldn't possibly have caused so much bleeding. Detective Willard quickly focuses on Enzo as the prime suspect. The evidence looks damning. Janice has been photographing Enzo and Suzette together, looking too close. There's a motel record where Enzo supposedly met Suzette, and Enzo illegally purchased a gun with money from their account. Most damning of all, police find what they believe is the murder weapon, Enzo's pocket knife with his initials containing traces of Jonathan's blood despite being wiped clean. When Enzo is arrested, he confesses to the murder, claiming he killed Jonathan for the insurance money because they were broke. However, after he's taken away, Ada delivers a shocking confession to her mother. "I was the one who killed him." Ada reveals that after learning from Nico about the abuse he suffered at Jonathan's hands, being forced to play with toys while being recorded by camera, being locked in the room until he wet himself, and being threatened with harm to his family if he stopped visiting, she confronted Jonathan in the hidden room. When he blocked her exit and threatened that he can't let her leave, she used the pocket knife her father had given her for protection, stabbing Jonathan in the belly and twisting it as her father had taught her. Meanwhile, Suzette has her own secrets. Her fingerprints are found in the hidden room, revealing she knew everything about her husband's perversion, yet still allowed Nico to visit. Even worse, blood and DNA from the missing child, Braden Lundy, are found in that room. When confronted, she pathetically defends herself, saying she stayed with Jonathan to prevent him from hurting other children and that calling the police would have ruined her life. The resolution of Jonathan's murder showcases the complex moral landscape of the story. Though Ada killed Jonathan, she did so in self-defense after discovering his abuse of her brother and other children. As Millie tells her tearful daughter, this isn't her fault. She acted to protect herself when cornered by a predator. Rather than allowing her 11-year-old daughter to face legal consequences, Millie calls Enzo's lawyer, Cecilia Winchester, who, in another twist of fate, was once a child Millie nannied for years ago. Cecilia reminds Millie that no court would prosecute an 11-year-old as an adult and promises to stop Enzo from throwing himself on his sword for nothing. Meanwhile, Detective Benito Ramirez, an NYPD detective, friend of the family, and Ada's godfather, helps Millie confront Suzette with the evidence of her complicity in Jonathan's crimes. they give her two choices: confess to killing her husband or be prosecuted for conspiracy in Braden Lundysgeth. Facing these options, Suzette chooses to confess to Jonathan's murder to protect herself from the more serious charges related to Braden's death. 2 weeks after Suzette's confession, all charges against Enzo are dropped and he returns home to his family. Only the Accardis know Ada's true role in Jonathan's death, a secret they'll protect to preserve their daughter's future. As Ramirez reminds them before leaving, Ada did what she had to do, though Enzo regrets giving her the knife that made it possible. The epilogue reveals one final twist. Martha, the housekeeper who blackmailed Millie, had specifically sought out the Accardi family after recognizing Millie from news coverage of her murder trial years ago. Having witnessed the same wealthy predator's behavior with another girl before his death at Millie's hands, Martha saw the Accardis as her ticket to escape her own abusive husband. This connection completes the circle of justice and revenge that runs throughout the story. In the aftermath of these events, the Accardi family begins the process of healing. Though they carry the weight of what happened, they find moments of normalcy, having breakfast together, planning a summer vacation to Disneyland, and sending the children back to school. For Ada, the experience has changed her in ways that mirror her mother's development. When a boy at school persistently harasses her despite her refusals and cruelly mentions her father's jail time, she delivers a chilling threat that makes him call her a psychopath and stumble away in fear. Looking at her reflection afterward, she realizes something she never noticed before. As she's gotten older, her features have become remarkably similar to her mother's. "I look just like her," she observes, recognizing not just the physical resemblance, but the inheritance of her mother's protective ferocity. Millie worries about this legacy she's passed to her daughter. Though Enzo insists Ada will be fine, just like Millie was, she can't help but wonder about the long-term effects of trauma and violence on a child. The cycle of abuse and protection that defined Millie's own life has now touched her daughter's, creating a complex inheritance of both strength and burden. Yet, there's also hope in this legacy. Ada's actions, while violent, saved her brother from further abuse and potentially other children from becoming Jonathan's victims. Like her mother before her, she acted to protect someone vulnerable when the systems designed to provide that protection failed. In this morally complex world, where justice often requires personal intervention, the Accardi family has found their own way to survive and protect each other, even when it means crossing lines others wouldn't dare to cross. The hidden rooms that once harbored secrets have been exposed to light, but the family carries new secrets now, ones they'll protect fiercely to preserve the normal life they fought so hard to build.